Pleasure is then reached by contractions of the inside surface of the vagina. Do these contractions result in a precise and definitive orgasm? This point is still being debated. The anatomical data are vague. There is a great deal of anatomic and clinical evidence that most of the interior of the vagina is without nerves, states, among other things, the Kinsey Report. A considerable amount of surgery may be performed inside the vagina without need for anesthetics. Nerves have been demonstrated inside the vagina only in an area in the anterior wall, proximate to the base of the clitoris. However, in addition to the stimulation of this innervated zone, the female may be conscious of the intrusion of an object into the vagina, particularly if vaginal muscles are tightened. But the satisfaction so obtained is probably related more to muscle tonus than it is to erotic nerve stimulation. Note, the Kinsey Reports are two books on human sexual behavior. Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, 1948, and Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, 1953, by Alfred Kinsey, Wardell Pomeroy, and others. Translation. Yet it is beyond doubt that vaginal pleasure exists, and even vaginal masturbation, for adult women, seems to be more widespread than Kinsey says. Note, the use of an artificial penis in solitary sexual gratification may be traced down from classic times, and doubtless prevailed in the very earliest human civilization. In more recent years, the following are a few of the objects found in the vagina or bladder whence they could only be removed by surgical interference: pencils, sticks of sealing wax, cotton reels, hairpins, and in Italy, very commonly, the bone pins used in the hair, bodkins, knitting needles, crochet needles, needle cases, compasses, glass stoppers, candles, corks, tumblers, forks, toothpicks, toothbrushes, pomade pots, in a case recorded by Schroeder, with a cockchafer inside, a makeshift substitute for the Japanese Rin no Tama. While in one recent English case, a full-sized hen's egg was removed from the vagina of a middle-aged married woman. The large objects naturally are found chiefly in the vagina and in married women. Havelock Ellis, Studies in the Psychology of Sex, Volume 1. But what is certain is that the vaginal reaction is very complex and can be qualified as psychophysiological because it not only concerns the entire nervous system, but also depends on the whole situation lived by the subject. It requires profound consent of the individual as a whole. To establish itself, the new erotic cycle launched by the first coitus demands a kind of preparation of the nervous system, the elaboration of a totally new form that has to include the clitoral system as well. It takes a long time to be put in place, and sometimes it never succeeds in being created. It is striking that woman has the choice between two cycles, one of which perpetuates youthful independence, while the other destines her to man and children. The normal sexual act effectively makes woman dependent on the male and the species. It is he, as for most animals, who has the aggressive role and she who submits to his embrace. Ordinarily, she can be taken at any time by man, while he can take her only when he is in the state of erection. Feminine refusal can be overcome, except in the case of a rejection as profound as vaginismus, sealing woman more securely than the hymen. Still, vaginismus leaves the male means to relieve himself on a body that his muscular force permits him to reduce to his mercy. Since she is object, her inertia does not profoundly alter her natural role. To the extent that many men are not interested in whether the woman who shares their bed wants coitus or only submits to it. One can even go to bed with a dead woman. Coitus cannot take place without male consent, and male satisfaction is its natural end result. Fertilization can occur without the woman deriving any pleasure. On the other hand, fertilization is far from representing the completion of the sexual process for her. By contrast, it is at this moment that the service demanded of her by the species begins. It takes place slowly and painfully in pregnancy, birth, and breastfeeding. Man's anatomical destiny is profoundly different from woman's. Their moral and social situations are no less different. patriarchal civilization condemned woman to chastity. The right of man to relieve his sexual desires is more or less openly recognized, whereas woman is confined within marriage. For her, the act of the flesh, if not sanctified by the code, by a sacrament, is a fault, a fall, a defeat, a weakness. She is obliged to defend her virtue, her honor. If she gives in, or if she falls, she arouses disdain, whereas even the blame inflicted on her vanquisher brings him admiration. From primitive civilizations to our times, the bed has always been accepted as a service for a woman, for which the male thanks her with gifts or guarantees her keep. But to serve is to give herself up to a master. There is no reciprocity at all in this relationship. The marriage structure, like the existence of prostitutes, proves it. The woman gives herself. The man remunerates her and takes her. Nothing forbids the male to act the master, to take inferior creatures. Ancillary loves have always been tolerated, whereas the bourgeois woman who gives herself to a chauffeur or a gardener is socially degraded. Fiercely racist American men in the South have always been permitted by custom to sleep with black women, before the Civil War as today, and they exploit this right with a lordly arrogance. A white woman who had relations with a black man in the time of slavery would have been put to death, and today she would be lynched. To say he slept with a woman, a man says he possessed her, that he had her. On the contrary, to have someone is sometimes vulgarly expressed as to fuck someone. The Greeks called a woman who did not have sexual relations with the male parthenos adamatos, an untaken virgin. The Romans called Messalina invicta because none of her lovers gave her satisfaction. So for the male lover, the love act is conquest and victory, while in another man, the erection often seems like a ridiculous parody of voluntary action, each one nonetheless considers it in his own case with a certain pride. Male's erotic vocabulary is inspired by military vocabulary. The lover has the ardor of a soldier. His sexual organ stiffens like a bow. When he ejaculates, he discharges. It is a machine gun, a cannon. He speaks of attack, assault, of victory. In his arousal, there is a certain flavor of the heroic. The generative act consisting of the occupation of one being by another, writes Benda, imposes on the one hand the idea of a conqueror, on the other of something conquered. Thus, when they refer to their most civilized love relationships, they talk of conquest, attack, assault, siege and defense, defeat and capitulation, clearly copying the idea of love from that of war. This act, involving the pollution of one being by another, imposes a certain pride on the polluter and some humiliation on the polluted, even when she is consenting. Note, Uriel's report. This last phrase introduces a new myth, that man inflicts a stain on woman. In fact, sperm is not excrement. One speaks of nocturnal pollution because the sperm does not serve its natural purpose. While coffee can stain a light-colored dress, it is not said to be waste that defiles the stomach. Other men maintain, by contrast, that woman is impure because it is she who is soiled by discharges, and that she pollutes the male. In any case, being the one who pollutes confers a dubious superiority. In fact, man's privileged situation comes from the integration of his biologically aggressive role into his social function of chief and master. It is through this function that physiological differences take on all their full meaning. Because man is sovereign in this world, he claims the violence of his desires as a sign of his sovereignty. It is said of a man endowed with great erotic capacities that he is strong and powerful, epithets that describe him as an activity and a transcendence. On the contrary, woman, being only an object, is considered hot or cold. That is, she will never manifest any qualities other than passive ones. So the climate in which feminine sexuality awakens is nothing like the one surrounding the adolescent boy. Besides, when woman faces the male for the first time, her erotic attitude is very complex. It is not true, as has been held at times, that the virgin does not know desire and that the male awakens her sensuality. This legend once again betrays the male's taste for domination, never wanting his companion to be autonomous, even in the desire that she has for him. In fact, for man as well, desire is often aroused through contact with woman. And, on the contrary, most young girls feverishly long for caresses before a hand ever touches them. Isadora Duncan, in My Life, says, "My hips, which had been like a boy's, took on another undulation, and through my whole being I felt one great surging, longing, unmistakable urge, so that I could no longer sleep at night, but tossed and turned in feverish, painful unrest." In a long confession of her life to Stekel, a young woman recounts, "I began vigorously to flirt. I had to have my nerves tickler. I was a passionate dancer, and while dancing I always shut my eyes the better to enjoy it. During dancing, I was somewhat exhibitionistic. My sensuality seemed to overcome my feeling of shame. During the first year, I danced with avidity and great enjoyment. I slept many hours, masturbated daily, often keeping it up for an hour. I masturbated often until I was covered with sweat, too fatigued to continue. I fell asleep. I was burning, and I would have taken anyone who would relieve me. I wasn't looking for a person, just a man." Note, Frigidity in Woman. The issue here is rather that virginal agitation is not expressed as a precise need. The virgin does not know exactly what she wants. Aggressive childhood eroticism still survives in her. Her first impulses were prehensile, and she still has the desire to embrace, to possess. She wants the prey that she covets to be endowed with the qualities which through taste, smell, and touch have been shown to her as values. For sexuality is not an isolated domain. It extends the dreams and joys of sensuality. Children and adolescents of both sexes like what is smooth, creamy, satiny, soft, elastic, that which yields to pressure without collapsing or decomposing and slips under the gaze or the fingers. Like man, woman is charmed by the warm softness of sand dunes, so often compared to breasts, or the light touch of silk, or the fluffy softness of an eiderdown, the velvet feeling of a flower or fruit, and the young girl especially cherishes the pale colors of pastels, froths of tulle and muslin. She has no taste for rough fabrics, gravel, rocks, bitter flavors, acrid odors. Like her brothers, it was her mother's flesh that she first caressed and cherished. In her narcissism, in her diffuse or precise homosexual experiences, she posited herself as a subject, and she sought the possession of a female body. When she faces the male, she has, in the palms of her hands and on her lips, the desire to actively caress a prey. But man, with his hard muscles, his scratchy and often hairy skin, his crude odor, and his coarse features, does not seem desirable to her, and he even stirs her repulsion. René Vivien expresses it this way, "I am a woman. I have no right to beauty. They have condemned me to the ugliness of men. They have forbidden me your hair, your eyes, because your hair is long and scented with odors." Note, At the Sweet Hour of Hand in Hand, translation Gillian Spraggs, translation. If the prehensile possessive tendency exists in woman more strongly, her orientation, like that of René Vivien, will be toward homosexuality, or she will become attached only to males she can treat like women. Thus, the heroine of Rachilde's Monsieur Venus buys herself a young lover whom she enjoys caressing passionately, but will not let herself be deflowered by him. There are women who love to caress young boys of 13 or 14 years old, or even children, and to reject grown men. But we have seen that passive sexuality has also been developed since childhood in the majority of women. The woman loves to be hugged and caressed, and especially from puberty, she wishes to be flesh in the arms of a man. The role of subject is normally his. She knows it. A man does not need to be handsome, she has been told over and over. She should not look for the inert qualities of an object in him, but for strength and virile force. She thus becomes divided within herself. She wants a strong embrace that will turn her into a trembling thing, but brutality and force are also hostile obstacles that wound her. Her sensuality is located both in her skin and in her hand, and their exigencies are in opposition to each other. Whenever possible, she chooses a compromise. She gives herself to a man who is virile but young and seductive enough to be an object of desire. She will be able to find all the traits she desires in a handsome adolescent. In the Song of Songs, there is a symmetry between the delights of the wife and those of the husband. She grasps in him what he seeks in her, earthly fauna and flora, precious stones, streams, stars. But she does not have the means to take these treasures. Her anatomy condemns her to remaining awkward and impotent, like a eunuch. The desire for possession is thwarted for lack of an organ to incarnate it, and man refuses the passive role. Often, besides, circumstances lead the young girl to become the prey of a male whose caresses move her, but whom she has no pleasure to look at or caress in return. Not enough has been said not only about the fear of masculine aggressiveness, but also about a deep feeling of frustration at the disgust that is mixed with her desires. Sexual satisfaction must be achieved against the spontaneous thrust of her sensuality, while for the man, the joy of touching and seeing merges with the sexual experience as such. Even the elements of passive eroticism are ambiguous. Nothing is murkier than contact. Many men who triturate all sorts of material in their hands without disgust hate it when grass or animals touch them. Woman's flesh can tremble pleasantly or bristle at the touch of silk or velvet. I recall a childhood friend who had goose flesh simply at the sight of a peach. The transition is easy from agitation to titillation, from irritation to pleasure. Arms enlacing a body can be a refuge and protection, but they also imprison and suffocate. For the virgin, this ambiguity is perpetuated because of her paradoxical situation. The organ that will bring about her metamorphosis is sealed. Her flesh's uncertain and burning longing spreads through her whole body, except in the very place where coitus should occur. No organ permits the virgin to satisfy her active eroticism, and she does not have the lived experience of he who dooms her to passivity. However, this passivity is not pure inertia. For the woman to be aroused, positive phenomena must be produced in her organism. Stimulation in erogenous zones, swelling of certain erectile tissue, secretions, temperature rise, pulse, and breathing acceleration. Desire and sexual pleasure demand a vital expenditure for her as for the male. Receptive, the female need is in one sense active and is manifested in an increase of nervous and muscular energy. Apathetic and languid women are always cold. There is a question as to whether constitutional frigidity exists, and surely psychic factors play a preponderant role in the erotic capacities of woman. But it is certain that physiological insufficiencies and a depleted vitality are manifested in part by sexual indifference. If, on the other hand, vital energy is spent in voluntary activities, sports, for example, it is not invested in sex. Scandinavians are healthy, strong, and cold. Fiery women are those who combine their languor with fire, like Italian or Spanish women, that is to say, women whose ardent vitality flows from their flesh. To make oneself object, to make oneself passive, is very different from being a passive object. A woman in love is neither asleep nor a corpse. There is a surge in her that ceaselessly falls and rises. It is this surge that creates the spell that perpetuates desire. But the balance between ardor and abandon is easy to destroy. Male desire is tension. It can invade a body where nerves and muscles are taut. Positions and movements that demand a voluntary participation of the organism do not work against it, and instead often serve it. On the contrary, every voluntary effort keeps female flesh from being taken. This is why the woman spontaneously refuses forms of coitus that demand work and tension from her. Too many and too abrupt changes in position, the demands of consciously directed activities, actions, or words, break the spell. Note, we will hear further on that there can be psychological reasons that modify her immediate attitude. The violence of uncontrolled tendencies can bring about tightening, contraction, or tension. Some women scratch or bite, their bodies arching, infused with an unaccustomed force. But these phenomena are only produced when a certain paroxysm is attained. And it is attained only if first the absence of all inhibition, physical as well as moral, permits a concentration of all living energy into the sexual act. This means that it is not enough for the young girl to let it happen. If she is docile, languid, or removed, she satisfies neither her partner nor herself. She must participate actively in an adventure that neither her virgin body nor her consciousness, laden with taboos, prohibitions, prejudices, and exigencies, desires positively. In the conditions just described, it is understandable that woman's erotic beginnings are not easy. Quite frequently, incidents that occur in childhood and youth provoke deep resistance in her, as has been seen. Sometimes it is insurmountable. Most often, the young girl tries to overcome it, but violent conflicts build up in her. Her strict education, the fear of sinning, and feelings of guilt toward her mother all create powerful blocks. Virginity is valued so highly in many circles that to lose it outside marriage seems a veritable disaster. The young girl who surrenders by coercion or by surprise thinks she dishonors herself. The wedding night, which delivers the virgin to a man whom she has ordinarily not even chosen, and which attempts to condense into a few hours or instants the entire sexual initiation, is not a simple experience. In general, any passage is distressing because of its definitive and irreversible character. Becoming a woman is breaking with the past without recourse. But this particular passage is more dramatic than any other. It creates not only a hiatus between yesterday and tomorrow, it tears the young girl from the imaginary world where a great part of her existence took place and hurls her into the real world. By analogy with a bullfight, Michel Leiris calls the nuptial bed a moment of truth. For the virgin, this expression takes on its fullest and most fearsome meaning. During the engagement, dating, or courtship period, however basic it may have been, she continued to live in her familiar universe of ceremony and dreams. The suitor spoke a romantic or at least courteous language. It was still possible to make believe. And suddenly, there she is, gazed upon by real eyes, handled by real hands. It is the implacable reality of this gazing and grasping that terrifies her. Both anatomy and customs confer the role of initiator on the man. Without doubt, for the young male virgin, his first mistress also provides his initiation. But he possesses an erotic autonomy clearly manifested in the erection. His mistress only delivers to him the object in its reality that he already desires, a woman's body. The young girl needs a man to make her discover her own body. Her dependence is much greater. From his very first experiences, man is ordinarily active and decisive, whether he pays his partner or courts and solicits her. By contrast, in most cases, the young girl is courted and solicited. Even if it is she who first flirts with the man, he is the one who takes their relationship in hand. He is often older and more experienced, and it is accepted that he has the responsibility for this adventure that is new for her. His desire is more aggressive and imperious. Lover or husband, he is the one who leads her to the bed, where her only choice is to let go of herself and obey. Even if she had accepted this authority in her mind, she is panic-stricken the moment she must concretely submit to it. She first of all fears this gaze that engulfs her. Her modesty may have been taught her, but it has deep roots. Men and women all know the shame of their flesh. In its pure, immobile presence, its unjustified imminence, The flesh exists in the gaze of another as the absurd contingents of facticity. And yet flesh is oneself. We want to prevent it from existing for others. We want to deny it. There are men who say they cannot stand to be naked in front of a woman, except in the state of erection. Through the erection, the flesh becomes activity, force. The penis is no longer an inert object, but, like the hand or the face, the imperious expression of a subjectivity. This is one reason why modesty paralyzes young men much less than young women. Their aggressive role exposes them less to being gazed at, and, if they are, they do not fear being judged because it is not inert qualities that their mistresses demand of them. It is rather their amorous potency and their skill at giving pleasure that will give rise to complexes. At least they can defend themselves and try to win their match. Woman does not have the option of transforming her flesh into will. When she stops hiding it, she gives it up without defenses. Even if she longs for caresses, she recoils from the idea of being seen and felt. All the more so as her breasts and buttocks are particularly fleshy. Many adult women cannot bear to be seen from the rear, even when they are dressed. Imagine the resistance a naive girl in love has to overcome to consent to showing herself. A phryne undoubtedly does not fear being gazed at. She bears herself, on the contrary, superbly. Her beauty clothes her. But even if she is the equal of phryne, a young girl never feels it with certainty. She cannot have arrogant pride in her body as long as male approval has not confirmed her young vanity. And this is just what frightens her. The lover is even more terrifying than a gaze. He is a judge. He is going to reveal her to herself in her truth. Even passionately taken with her own image, every young girl doubts herself at the moment of the masculine verdict. This is why she demands darkness. She hides in the sheets. When she admired herself in the mirror, she was only dreaming. She was dreaming through man's eyes. Now the eyes are really there, impossible to cheat, impossible to fight. A mysterious freedom decides, and this decision is final. In the real ordeal of the erotic experience, the obsessions of childhood and adolescence will finally fade or be confirmed forever. Many young girls suffer from muscular calves, breasts that are too little or too big, narrow hips, a wart, or else they fear some secret malformation. Stekel writes, "Every young girl carries in her all sorts of ridiculous fears that she barely dares to admit to herself. One would not believe how many young girls suffer from the obsession of being physically abnormal and torment themselves secretly because they cannot be sure of being normally constructed. One young girl, for example, believed that her lower opening was not in the right place. She thought that sexual intercourse took place through the navel. She was unhappy because her navel was closed and she could not stick her finger in it. Another thought she was a hermaphrodite, and another thought she was crippled and would never be able to have sexual relations." Note, Frigidity in Woman. Even if they are unfamiliar with these obsessions, they are terrified by the idea that certain regions of their bodies that did not exist for them or for anyone, that absolutely did not exist, will suddenly be seen. Will this unknown figure that the young girl must assume as her own provoke disgust, indifference, irony? She can only submit to male judgment. The die is cast. This is why man's attitude will have such deep resonance. His ardor and tenderness can give woman a confidence in herself that will stand up to every rejection. Until she is 80 years old, she will believe she is this flower, this exotic bird that made man's desire bloom one night. On the contrary, if the lover or husband is clumsy, he will arouse an inferiority complex in her that is sometimes compounded by long-lasting neuroses, and she will hold a grudge that will be expressed in a stubborn frigidity. Stekel describes striking examples. A woman of 36 years of age suffers from such back pain across the small of her back for the past 14 years. These pains are so unbearable that she is forced to stay in bed for weeks. She felt the great pains for the first time during her wedding night. On that occasion, during the defloration, which caused her considerable pain, her husband exclaimed, "You have deceived me! You are not a virgin!" Her pains in the back represent the fixation of this painful episode. Her illness is her vengeance on the man. The various cures have cost him considerable money for her innumerable treatments. This woman was anesthetic during her wedding night, and she remained in this condition throughout her marital experience. The wedding night was for her a terrible mental shock that has influenced her whole life. A woman consults me for various nervous troubles, and particularly on account of her complete sexual frigidity. During her wedding night, her husband, after uncovering her, exclaimed, "Oh, how stubby and thick your limbs are!" Then he tried to carry out intercourse. She felt only pain and remained wholly frigid. She knows very well that the slightest remark he made about her during the wedding night was responsible for her sexual frigidity. Another frigid woman says that during her wedding night, her husband deeply insulted her. Seeing her get undressed, he allegedly said, "My God, how thin you are!" Then he nevertheless decided to caress her. For her, this moment was unforgettable and horrible. What brutality! Mrs. ZW is also completely frigid. The great traumatism of her wedding night was that her husband supposedly said after the first intercourse, "You have a big hole. You tricked me." The gaze is danger. Hands are another threat. Woman does not usually have access to the universe of violence. She has never gone through the ordeal the young man overcame in childhood and adolescent fights, to be a thing of flesh on which others have a hold. And now that she is grasped, she is swept away in a body-to-body clasp where man is the stronger. She is no longer free to dream, to withdraw, to maneuver. She is given over to the male. He disposes of her. These wrestling-like embraces terrorize her, she who has never wrestled. She had let herself go to the caresses of a fiancé, a fellow student, a colleague, a civilized and courteous man. But he has assumed an unfamiliar, selfish, and stubborn attitude. She no longer has recourse against the stranger. It is not uncommon that the young girl's first experience is a real rape, and that man's behavior is odiously brutal. Particularly in the countryside, where customs are harsh, it often happens that a young peasant woman, half consenting, half outraged, in shame and fright, loses her virginity at the bottom of some ditch. What is, in any case, extremely frequent in all societies and classes is that the virgin is rushed by an egotistical lover seeking his own pleasure quickly, or by a husband convinced of his conjugal rights, who takes his wife's resistance as an insult, to the point of becoming furious if the defloration is difficult. In any case, however deferential and courteous a man might be, the first penetration is always a violation. While she desires caresses on her lips and breasts and perhaps yearns for a familiar or anticipated orgasm, here is a male sex organ tearing the young girl and introducing itself into regions where it was not invited. The painful surprise of a swooning virgin who thinks she has finally reached the accomplishment of her voluptuous dreams and who feels in the secret of her sex an unexpected pain, in a husband's or lover's arms, has often been described. The dreams faint away, the excitement dissipates, and love takes on the appearance of a surgical operation. In the confessions gathered by Dr. Liebmann, there is the following and typical account. It concerns a very sexually unaware girl from a modest background. "I often imagined that one could have a child just by the exchange of a kiss. During my 18th year, I made the acquaintance of a man with whom I really fell madly in love. She often went out with him, and during their conversations, he explained to her that when a young girl loves a man, she must give herself to him because men cannot live without sexual relations, and that as long as they cannot afford to get married, they have to have relations with young girls. She resisted. One day, he organized an excursion so that they could spend the night together. She wrote him a letter to repeat that it would harm her too much. The morning of the arranged day, she gave him the letter, but he put it in his pocket without reading it and took her to the hotel. He dominated her morally. She loved him. She followed him. I was as if hypnotized. As we were going along, I begged him to spare me. How I arrived at the hotel, I do not know at all. The only memory that remained is that my whole body trembled violently. My companion tried to calm me, but he succeeded only after much resistance. I was no longer mistress of my will, and in spite of myself, I let myself go. When I found myself later in the street, it seemed to me that everything had only been a dream I had just awakened from. She refused to repeat the experience and for 9 years did not have sexual relations with any other man. She then met one who asked her to marry him, and she agreed. Note, published in French under the title Jeunesse et Sexualité, Youth and Sexuality. In this case, the defloration was a kind of rape, but even if it is consensual, it can be painful. Look at the fevers that tormented young Isadora Duncan. She met an admirably handsome actor with whom she fell in love at first sight and who courted her ardently. I myself felt ill and dizzy, while an irresistible longing to press him closer and closer surged in me until, losing all control and falling into a fury, he carried me into the room. Frightened but ecstatic, the realization was made clear to me. I confess my first impressions were a horrible fright, but a great pity for what he seemed to be suffering prevented me from running away from what was at first sheer torture. The next day, what had been for me only a painful experience began again amid my martyr's sobs and cries. Note, my life. She was soon to know the paradise she lyrically described, first with this lover, and then with others. However, in actual experience, as previously in one's virginal imagination, it is not pain that plays the greatest role. The fact of penetration counts far more. In intercourse, the man introduces only an exterior organ. Woman is affected in her deepest interior. Undoubtedly, there are many young men who tread with anguish in the secret darkness of woman. Their childhood terrors resurface at the threshold of caves and graves, and so does their fright in front of jaws, scythes, and wolf traps. They imagine that their swollen penis will be caught in the mucus sheath. The woman, once penetrated, does not have this feeling of danger, but she does feel carnally alienated. The property owner affirms his rights over his lands. The housewife over her house by proclaiming no trespassing. Because of their frustrated transcendence, women in particular jealously defend their privacy. Their room, their wardrobe, and their chests are sacred. Colette tells of an old prostitute who told her one day, "In my room, madame, no man has ever set foot. For what I have to do with men, Paris is quite big enough." If not her body, at least she possessed a plot of land where entry was prohibited. The young girl, though, possesses little of her own except her body. It is her most precious treasure. The man who enters her takes it from her. The familiar word is confirmed by her lived experience. She experiences concretely the humiliation she had felt. She is dominated, subjugated, conquered. Like almost all females, she is under the man during intercourse. Note, the position can undoubtedly be reversed, but in the first experiences, it is extremely rare for the man not to practice the so-called normal coitus. Adler emphasized the feeling of inferiority resulting from this. Right from infancy, the notions of superior and inferior are extremely important. Climbing trees is a prestigious act. Heaven is above the earth. Hell is underneath. To fall or to descend is to degrade oneself, and to climb is to exalt oneself. In wrestling, victory belongs to the one who pins his opponent down, whereas the woman lies on the bed in a position of defeat. It is even worse if the man straddles her like an animal subjugated by reins and a bit. In any case, she feels passive. She is caressed, penetrated. She undergoes intercourse, whereas the man spends himself actively. It is true that the male sex organ is not a striated muscle commanded by will. It is neither plowshare nor sword, but merely flesh. But it is a voluntary movement that man imprints on her. He goes, he comes, stops, resumes, while the woman receives him submissively. It is the man, especially when the woman is a novice, who chooses the amorous positions, who decides the length and frequency of intercourse. She feels herself to be an instrument. All the freedom is in the other. This is what is poetically expressed by saying that woman is comparable to a violin and man to the bow that makes her vibrate. In love, says Balzac, leaving the soul out of consideration, woman is a lyre which only yields up its secrets to the man who can play upon it skillfully. Note, Physiology of Marriage. In Breviaire de l'amour expérimental, A Ritual for Married Lovers, Jules Guyot also says of the husband, he is the minstrel who produces harmony or cacophony with his hand and bow. From this point of view, woman is really a many-stringed instrument, producing harmonious or discordant sounds depending on how she is tuned. He takes his pleasure with her. He gives her pleasure. The words themselves do not imply reciprocity. Woman is imbued with collective images of the glorious aura of masculine sexual excitement that make feminine arousal a shameful abdication. Her intimate experience confirms this asymmetry. It must not be forgotten that boy and girl adolescents experience their bodies differently. The former tranquilly takes his body for granted and proudly takes charge of his desires. For the latter, in spite of her narcissism, it is a strange and disturbing burden. Man's sex organ is neat and simple, like a finger. It can be innocently exhibited, and boys often show it off to their friends proudly and defiantly. The feminine sex organ is mysterious to the woman herself, hidden, tormented, mucus, and humid. It bleeds each month. It is sometimes soiled with bodily fluids. It has a secret and dangerous life. It is largely because woman does not recognize herself in it that she does not recognize her own desires. They are expressed in a shameful manner. While the man has a hard-on, the woman gets wet. There is, in the very word, infantile memories of the wet bed, of the guilty and involuntary desire to urinate. Man has the same disgust for his nocturnal unconscious wet dreams. Projecting a liquid, urine or sperm, is not humiliating. It is an active operation, but there is humiliation if the liquid escapes passively, since the body then is no longer an organism, muscles, sphincters, and nerves, commanded by the brain and expressing the conscious subject, but a vase, a receptacle made of inert matter, and the plaything of mechanical caprices. If the flesh oozes, like an old wall or a dead body, it does not seem to be emitting liquid, but deliquescing, a decomposition process that horrifies. Feminine heat is the flaccid palpitation of a shellfish. Where man has impetuousness, woman merely has impatience. Her desire can become ardent without ceasing to be passive. The man dives on his prey like the eagle and the hawk. She, like a carnivorous plant, waits for and watches the swamp where insects and children bog down. She is sucking, suction, sniffer. She is pitch and glue, immobile appeal, insinuating and viscous. At least this is the way she indefinably feels. Thus, there is not only resistance against the male who attempts to subjugate her, but also internal conflict. Superimposed on the taboos and inhibitions that arise from her education and society are disgust and refusals that stem from the erotic experience itself. They all reinforce each other to such an extent that often, after the first coitus, the woman is more in revolt against her sexual destiny than before. Lastly, there is another factor that often gives man a hostile look and changes the sexual act into a grave danger. The danger of a child. An illegitimate child in most civilizations is such a social and economic handicap for the unmarried woman that one sees young girls committing suicide when they know they are pregnant, and unwed mothers cutting the throats of their newborns. Such a risk constitutes a quite powerful sexual break, making many young girls observe the prenuptial chastity prescribed by customs. When the break is insufficient, the young girl, while yielding to the lover, is horrified by the terrible danger he possesses in his loins. Stekel cites, among others, a young girl who for the entire duration of intercourse shouted, "Don't let anything happen! Don't let anything happen!" Even in marriage, the woman often does not want a child. Her health is not good enough, or a child would be too great a burden on the young household. Whether he is lover or husband, if she does not have absolute confidence in her partner, her eroticism will be paralyzed by caution. Either she will anxiously watch the man's behavior, or else, once intercourse is over, she will run to the bathroom to chase the living germ from her belly, put there in spite of herself. This hygienic operation brutally contradicts the sensual magic of the caresses. She undergoes an absolute separation of the bodies that were merged in one single joy. Thus, the male sperm becomes a harmful germ, a soiling. She cleans herself as one cleans a dirty vase, while the man reclines on his bed in his superb wholeness. A young divorcee told me how horrified she was when, after a dubiously pleasurable wedding night, she had to shut herself in the bathroom and her husband nonchalantly lit a cigarette. It seems that the ruin of the couple was decided at that instant. The repugnance of the douche, the beaker, and the bidet is one of the frequent causes of feminine frigidity. The existence of surer and more convenient contraceptive devices is helping woman's sexual freedom a great deal. In a country like America, where these practices are widespread, the number of young girls still virgins at marriage is much lower than in France. Such practices make for far greater abandon during the love act. But there again, the young woman has to overcome her repugnance before treating her body as a thing. She can no more resign herself to being corked to satisfy a man's desires than she can to being pierced by him. Whether she has her uterus sealed or introduces some sperm-killing tampon, a woman who is conscious of the ambiguities of the body and sex will be bridled by cold premeditation. Besides, many men consider the use of condoms repugnant. It is sexual behavior as a whole that justifies its various moments. Conduct that, when analyzed, would seem repugnant seems natural when bodies are transfigured by the erotic virtues they possess. But inversely, when bodies and behaviors are decomposed into separate elements and deprived of meaning, these elements become disgusting and obscene. The surgical and dirty perception that penetration had in the eyes of the child returns if it is not carried out with the arousal, desire, and pleasure a woman in love will joyfully experience as union and fusion with the beloved. This is what happens with the concerted use of prophylactics. In any case, these precautions are not at the disposal of all women. Many young girls do not know of any defense against the threats of pregnancy, and they feel great anguish that their lot depends on the goodwill of the man they give themselves up to. It is understandable that an ordeal experienced through so much resistance, fraught with such weighty implications, often creates serious traumas. A latent precocious dementia has often been revealed by the first experience. Stekel gives several examples. Miss M.G. suddenly developed an acute delirium in her 19th year. I found her storming in her room, shouting repeatedly, "I won't! No, I won't!" She tore off her clothes and wanted to flee into the street naked. She had to be taken to the psychiatric clinic. There her delirium gradually abated, and she passed into a catatonic state. This girl was a clerk in an office, in love with the head clerk in the company. She had gone to the country with a girlfriend and a couple of young men who worked in the same office. She went to her room with one of the men who promised not to touch her and that it was merely a prank. He roused her to slight tenderness for 3 nights without touching her virginity. She apparently remained as cold as a dog's muzzle, and declared that it was disgraceful. For a few fleeting minutes, her mind seemed confused, and she exclaimed, "Alfred! Alfred!" Alfred was the head clerk's first name. She was reproaching herself for what she had done. What would Mother say about this if she knew? Once she returned home, she took to her bed, complaining of a migraine. Miss LX, very depressed, she cried often and could not sleep. She had begun to have hallucinations and failed to recognize her environment. She had jumped to the windows and tried to throw herself out. She was taken to the sanitarium. I found this 23-year-old girl sitting up in bed. She paid no attention to me when I entered. Her face depicted abject fear and horror. Her limbs were crossed and they twitched vigorously. She was shouting, "No, no, no, you villain! Men such as you ought to be locked up! It hurts! Oh!" Then there followed some unintelligible mumbling. Suddenly, her whole facial expression changed. Her eyes lit up, her lips pursed in the manner of kissing someone. Her limbs ceased twitching, and she gave forth outcries which suggested delight and rapture and love. Finally, the attack ended in a subdued but persistent weeping. The patient kept pushing down her nightgown as if it were a dress, at the same time continually repeating the exclamation, "Don't!" It was known that a married colleague had often come to see her when she was ill, that she was first happy about it, but that later on she had had hallucinations and attempted suicide. Note, not in the English translation of Stekel's German text. Translation. She got better, but keeps all men at a distance, and has rejected an earnest marriage offer. Note, frigidity in woman, discrepancy in initials, KL, in the English translation of Stekel's German text. Translation. In other cases, the illness triggered is less serious. Here is an example where regret for lost virginity plays the main role in the problems following the first coitus. A young 23-year-old girl suffers from various phobias. The illness began at Franzensbad out of fear of catching a pregnancy by a kiss or a contact in a toilet. Perhaps a man had left some sperm in the water after masturbation. She insisted that the bathtub be cleaned 3 times in her presence and did not dare to move her bowels in the normal position. Sometime afterwards, she developed a phobia of tearing her hymen. She did not dare to dance, jump, cross a fence, or even walk except with very little steps. If she saw a post, she feared being deflowered by a clumsy movement and went around it, trembling all the way. Another of her phobias in a train or in the middle of a crowd was that a man could introduce his member from behind, deflower her, and provoke a pregnancy. During the last phase of the illness, she feared finding pins in her bed or on her shirt that could enter her vagina. Each evening, the sick girl stayed naked in the middle of her room, while her unfortunate mother was forced to go through a difficult examination of the bedclothes. She had always affirmed her love for her fiancé. An examination revealed that she was no longer a virgin and was putting off marriage because she feared her fiancé's disastrous observations. She admitted to him that she had been seduced by a tenor, married him, and was cured. Note, frigidity in woman. In another case, remorse, uncompensated by voluptuous satisfaction, provoked psychic troubles. Miss H.B., 20 years old, after a trip to Italy with a girlfriend, went into a serious depression. She refused to leave her room and did not utter one word. She was taken to a nursing home where her situation got worse. She heard voices that were insulting her. Everyone made fun of her, etc. She was brought back to her parents, where she stayed in a corner without moving. She asked the doctor, "Why didn't I come before the crime was committed?" She was dead. Everything was killed, destroyed. She was dirty. She could not sing one note. Bridges with the world were burnt. The fiancé admitted having followed her to Rome, where she gave herself to him after resisting a long time. She had crying fits. She admitted never having pleasure with her fiancé. She was cured when she found a lover who satisfied her and married her. The sweet Viennese girl, whose childish confessions I summarized, also gave a detailed and gripping account of her first adult experiences. It will be noticed that, in spite of the very advanced nature of her previous adventures, her initiation still has an absolutely new character. At 16, I began working in an office. At 17 and a half, I had my first holiday. It was a great period for me. I was courted on all sides. I was in love with a young office colleague. We went to the park. It was 15 April 1909. He made me sit next to him on a bench. He kissed me, begging me, "Open your lips," but I closed them convulsively. Then he began to unbutton my jacket. I would have let him when I remembered that I did not have any breasts. I gave up the voluptuous sensation I would have had if he had touched me. On 7 April, a married colleague invited me to go to an exhibition with him. We drank wine at dinner. I lost some of my reserve and began telling him some ambiguous jokes. In spite of my begging, he hailed a cab, pushed me into it, and hardly had the horses started than he kissed me. He became more and more intimate. He pushed his hand farther and farther. I defended myself with all my strength, and I do not remember if he got his way. The next day, I went to the office rather flustered. He showed me his hands covered with the scratches I had given him. He asked me to come see him more often. I yielded, not very comfortable, but still full of curiosity. As soon as he came near my sex, I pulled away and returned to my place. But once, more clever than I, he overcame me and probably put his finger into my vagina. I cried with pain. It was June 1909, and I left on vacation. I took a trip with my girlfriend. Two tourists arrived. They invited us to accompany them. My companion wanted to kiss my friend. She punched him. He came towards, grabbed me from behind, bent me to him, and kissed me. I did not resist. He invited me to come with him. I gave him my hand, and we went into the middle of the forest. He kissed me. He kissed my sex, to my great indignation. I said to him, "How can you do such a disgusting thing?" He put his penis in my hand. I caressed it. All of a sudden, he pulled away my hand and threw a handkerchief over it to keep me from seeing what was happening. 2 days later, we went to Leasing. All of a sudden, in a deserted field, he took off his coat and put it on the grass. He threw me down in such a way that one of his legs was placed between mine. I still did not think how serious the situation was. I begged him to kill me rather than deprive me of my most beautiful finery. He became very rough, swore at me, and threatened me with the police. He covered my mouth with his hand and introduced his penis. I thought my last hour had arrived. I had the feeling my stomach was turning. When he was finally finished, I began to be able to put up with him. He had to pick me up because I was still stretched out. He covered my eyes and face with kisses. I did not see or hear anything. If he had not held me back, I would have fallen blindly in front of the traffic. We were alone in a second-class compartment. He opened his trousers again to come towards me. I screamed and ran quickly through the whole train until the last running board. Finally, he left me with a vulgar and strident laugh that I will never forget, calling me a stupid goose who does not know what is good. He let me return to Vienna alone. I went quickly to the bathroom because I had felt something warm running along my thigh. Frightened, I saw traces of blood. How could I hide this at home? I went to bed as early as possible and cried for hours. I still felt the pressure on my stomach caused by the pushing of his penis. My strange attitude and lack of appetite told my mother something had happened. I admitted everything to her. She did not see anything so terrible in it. My colleague did what he could to console me. He took advantage of dark evenings to take walks with me in the park and caress me under my skirts. I let him, but as soon as I felt my vagina become wet, I pulled myself away because I was terribly ashamed. She goes to a hotel with him sometimes, but without sleeping with him. She makes the acquaintance of a very rich young man that she would like to marry. She sleeps with him, but without feeling anything and with disgust. She resumes her relations with her colleague, but she misses the other one and begins to be cross-eyed and to lose weight. She is sent to a sanitarium where she almost sleeps with a young Russian, but she chases him from her bed at the last minute. She begins affairs with a doctor and an officer, but without consenting to complete sexual relations. Then she became mortally ill and decided to go to a doctor. After her treatment, she consented to give herself to a man who loved her and then married her. In marriage, her frigidity disappeared. In these last few examples, chosen from many similar ones, the partner's brutality, or at least the abruptness of the event, is the determining factor in the traumatism or disgust. The best situation for sexual initiation is one in which the girl learns to overcome her modesty, to get to know her partner, and to enjoy his caresses without violence or surprise, without fixed rules or a precise time frame. In this respect, the freedom of behavior appreciated by young American girls and more by French girls today can only be endorsed. They slip almost without noticing from necking and petting to complete sexual relations. The less tabooed it is, the smoother the initiation, and the freer the girl feels with her partner, and the more the domination aspect of the male fades. If her lover is also young, a novice, shy, and an equal, the girl's defenses are not as strong, but her metamorphosis into a woman will also be less of a transformation. In Green Wheat, Colette's Vanka, the day after a rather brutal defloration, displays surprising placidity to her friend Phil. She did not feel possessed. On the contrary, she took pride in freeing herself of her virginity. She did not feel an overwhelming mental turmoil. In truth, Phil is wrong to be surprised, as his girlfriend did not really know the male. Claudine was less unaffected after a turn on the dance floor in Renaud's arms. I was told of a French high school student still stuck in the green fruit stage who, having spent a night with a male school friend, ran to a girlfriend's the next morning to announce, "I slept with C. It was a lot of fun." An American high school teacher told me his students stopped being virgins long before becoming women. Their partners respect them too much to offend their modesty. The boys themselves are too young and too prudish to awaken any demon in the girls. There are girls who throw themselves into many erotic experiences in order to escape sexual anxiety. They hope to rid themselves of their curiosity and obsessions, but their acts often have a theoretical cast, rendering such behavior as unreal as the fantasies through which others anticipate the future. Giving oneself out of defiance, fear, or Puritan rationalism is not achieving an authentic erotic experience. One merely reaches a pseudo-experience without danger and without much flavor. The sexual act is not accompanied by either anguish or shame, because arousal remains superficial and pleasure has not permeated the flesh. These deflowered virgins are still young girls, and it is likely that the day they find themselves in the grip of a sensual and imperious man, they will put up virginal resistance to him. Meanwhile, they remain in a kind of awkward age. Caresses tickle them. Kisses sometimes make them laugh. They look on physical love as a game, and if they are not in the mood to have fun, the lover's demands quickly seem importunate and abusive. They hold on to the disgusts, phobias, and prudishness of the adolescent girl. If they never go beyond this stage, which is, according to American males, the case with many American girls, they spend their lives in a state of semi-frigidity. Real sexual maturity for the woman who consents to becoming flesh can only occur in arousal and pleasure. But it must not be thought that all difficulties subside in women with a passionate temperament. On the contrary, they sometimes worsen. Feminine arousal can reach an intensity unknown by man. Male desire is violent but localized, and he comes out of it, except perhaps in the instant of ejaculation, conscious of himself. Woman, by contrast, undergoes a real alienation. For many, this metamorphosis is the most voluptuous and definitive moment of love, but it also has a magical and frightening side. The woman he is holding in his arms appears so absent from herself, so much in the throes of turmoil, that the man may feel afraid of her. The upheaval she feels is a far more radical transmutation than the male's aggressive frenzy. This fever frees her from shame, but when she awakes, it in turn makes her feel ashamed and horrified. For her to accept it happily, or even proudly, she has at least to be sexually and sensually fulfilled. She can admit to her desires if she has gloriously satisfied them. If not, she repudiates them angrily. Here we reach the crucial problem of feminine eroticism. At the beginning of her erotic life, woman's abdication is not rewarded by a wild and confident sensual pleasure. She would readily sacrifice modesty and pride if it meant opening up the gates of paradise. but it has been seen that defloration is not a successful accomplishment of youthful eroticism. It is, on the contrary, an unusual phenomenon. Vaginal pleasure is not attained immediately. According to Stekel's statistics, confirmed by many sexologists and psychologists, barely 4% of women experience pleasure at the first coitus. 50% do not reach vaginal pleasure for weeks, months, or even years. Psychic factors play an essential role in this. Woman's body is singularly hysterical in that there is often no distance between conscious facts and their organic expression. Her moral inhibitions prevent the emergence of pleasure. As they are not counterbalanced by anything, they are often perpetuated and form a more and more powerful barrier. In many cases, a vicious circle is created. The lover's first clumsiness, a word, an awkward gesture, or an arrogant smile will resonate throughout the whole honeymoon or even married life. Disappointed by not experiencing pleasure immediately, the young woman feels a resentment that badly prepares her for a happier experience. It is true that if the man cannot give her normal satisfaction, he can always give her clitoral pleasure that, in spite of moralizing legends, can provide her with relaxation and contentment. But many women reject it because it seems to be inflicted even more than vaginal pleasure. Because if women suffer from the egotism of men concerned only with their own satisfaction, they are also offended by too obvious a determination to give them pleasure. Making the other come, says Stekel, means dominating him. Giving oneself to someone is abdicating one's will. Woman will accept pleasure more easily if it seems to flow naturally from man's own pleasure, as happens in normal and successful coitus. Women submit themselves joyously as soon as they understand that the partner does not want to subjugate them, continues Stekel. Inversely, if they feel this desire, they resist. Many shy away from being caressed by the hand because it is an instrument that does not participate in the pleasure it gives.